Many people are convinced that God's laws are restrictive in a way that kills joy, in a way that inhibits freedom. Viewing God's commands that way, I think, is based on at least three errors. First, it underestimates the destructiveness of sin. If someone thinks that God's laws are unnecessarily restrictive and joy-killing, perhaps they've underestimated the nature of sin itself, which harms our souls, which damages our relationships. Sin kills joy. Sin is the enemy of true joy and peace. If someone is convinced that God's commands inhibit our freedom, perhaps, secondly, it's because they misunderstand the nature of freedom. Sin brings enslavement, the opposite of freedom. Sin shows up with chains and says, "Come with me." It invites us to shackle ourselves. Boundaries exist not to compromise freedom, but to preserve freedom. If you think of guardrails on a highway and the way that they guide and direct you, or think of a label on maybe a house cleaner bottle that says poison if ingested. If someone held up a poisonous bottle and whined about how their freedom to drink it was being restricted, wouldn't you look at them a little strange? It's like, well, you know what's in that, don't you? You know what would happen if you took that in, don't you? Maybe that declaration of poisonous if ingested is a loving thing to announce. Perhaps thirdly, someone who sees God's laws as joy-killing ignores the loving heart of God that is behind all of his commands. What if God's prohibitions are actually accomplishing a greater and deeper, more profound joy in life for his people? What if God's commands reveal the ways in which we can most faithfully love God and most faithfully love one another? In fact, isn't it Jesus who says in Matthew 22 that we could summarize all the law with the commandments of loving God with our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving our neighbor as ourselves? When we look at the commands in Leviticus and the commands we've seen in Exodus and more that are in front of Leviticus, we can see, distilling all of those commands down, God wants to help us love him, and he wants to help us love one another. These commands come from the loving heart of God. And so for at least these three errors, somebody might think that God's laws are really unnecessarily restrictive and are joy-killing, when really they might be underestimating the destructiveness of sin, they might be misunderstanding the nature of freedom, and they might ignore the loving heart of God behind it. We need all of these ideas in mind when we look at Leviticus 18 tonight. And I think when we look at the content of Leviticus 18, I think we would agree with one another that really the only reason you would hear a sermon from Leviticus 18 is because you're in a series on Leviticus. There's the nature of and content of what we're going to see tonight is unusually provocative, and that's saying something for Leviticus. The primary purpose of this chapter is to actually guide and guard the sexual activity of God's people. Guiding and guarding, boundaries and restrictions, commands and prohibitions. I want you to think, though, that Leviticus 18 comes from a heart of love, a heart of God's love for his people, for our good. There are instructions in this chapter that didn't appear previously in Genesis or Exodus, and so they're going to be mentioned tonight. In guiding the sexual relationships of his people, we know that Israelites were already prohibited from intermarrying with those who don't know the Lord. And that's because intermarrying with a pagan or intermarrying with a non-believing Gentile would lead to a life of compromise and idolatry. We actually see this worked out in the lives of characters who nevertheless pursued a life that was out of line with God's word. This would generally then eliminate Gentiles as options for marriage, unless a Gentile was willing to forsake idolatry and join the Israelite community. You see this in the example of Ruth. You see Ruth saying to Naomi, her mother-in-law, "Your God will be my God, your people my people." She goes to the promised land, and when she marries Boaz, Ruth is a believer in Yahweh. and is a righteous and honorable person seeking to serve and obey the Lord. And so when Boaz marries Ruth in Ruth 4, he's not marrying someone who was a pagan Gentile. She is a Gentile who is a believer in Yahweh. And that is what makes all the difference. And so if marriage options or marriage partners primarily existed within the Israelite community, it might be tempting to look within one's immediate clan or family for marriage options. And it's in Leviticus 18 that we find some direction here. Now, there are a few other laws in the mix as well, but most of Leviticus 18 is trying to eliminate marriage partners from within one's family. And this may have in view that somebody gets married, but their spouse dies and they're looking for a partner. Or someone is growing up within a household, and is the case in a lot of ancient households, multiple generations lived in that home. And as somebody is becoming of a marriageable age, perhaps, what is off limits, if you will, regarding options for building a family? Leviticus 18 is very important. It's important because Israel was delivered from Egypt that didn't have as broad a laws and as specific laws regarding incest and other relationships. In fact, we know from Egyptian records that ancient Egyptians practiced incest, especially among royalty. And the impulse behind that was most likely to keep the royal dynasty as within the family as possible. And so there were some political motives with this as well. We also know that even in Egyptian mythology, the gods Shu and Tefnut were actually brother and sister in the Egyptian pantheon, and yet were married in their Egyptian mythology. So let me just give you some examples that where the Israelites have come from, it may be necessary to actually provide some divinely revealed clarification on what is appropriate and what is not. But it's not even as simple as where they've come from. It's also a matter of where the Israelites are going. The Israelites are going into a land that is occupied by Canaanites who also have abominable practices. And the Israelites need to know that as a confessor of Yahweh, as someone who is following the laws of God, this will mean they're different from the land they came from, Egypt. It's also going to be they're living differently in the land they're going to. They're going to stand out among the Canaanites by what they're willing to do and not do. And so in verses 1 to 5, let's look at the opening call to follow God's laws. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the people of Israel, say to them, I'm the Lord, your God." This is a declaration with God naming himself as the authority who's going to deliver the following instructions. He's not someone without authority. These commands matter because he is the Lord their God. That's why they have to take this seriously. You know, if you had, you know, a young child in the family who's giving you commands and instructions, well, their authority and their position is quite limited. And so you may or may not, you know, choose to negotiate or compromise something. When you look at the phrase, I am the Lord your God, well, then you're dealing with the greatest possible authority in the universe speaking on a subject. And therefore, given the character and authority of God, everything that he says is relevant to them that follows. I am the Lord your God. And in verse 3, you shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived, and you shall not do as they do in the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you. Or there you have them, caught in the middle, if you will, at Mount Sinai, with Egypt behind them and the promised land of Canaan ahead. He says, you shall not walk in their statutes. In verse 4, you shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. You're going to walk according to something. Either some worldview or some sort of imbibed family traditions and maybe thoughts and understandings or convictions that your peers share or what you glean from movies. You are living out understandings and beliefs about relationship and sexuality. Someone has given you statutes. I wonder if they're from the Lord your God, though. In other words, I wonder if you can see how the highest and greatest authority of all the earth has the position from which to speak to these sensitive areas of life. He says, you shall follow, in verse 4, my rules, keep my statutes, and walk in them. And in verse 5, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord your God. Now, he doesn't just mean they're living physically. We know that the life here, according to the way Ezekiel understands it in Ezekiel 20, is a life in the promised land. If they keep the statutes of the law, they will be able to enjoy the blessing of life in the land, the blessing of God's favor in the promised land. But if they do not keep God's statutes, at the end of chapter 18, he threatens judgment. They won't enjoy the blessing of life. They instead will face the curse for abomination. They will be exiled. They will be vomited out of the land, is the language in chapter at the end of chapter 18. So when you look in Ezekiel, the Israelites have, at that point in Ezekiel's life, in the early 6th century B.C., they have been disobeying the Lord for quite some time. And their immorality and idolatry is addressed by the Lord. God says in Ezekiel 20:11, I gave them my statutes and made known to them my rules, by which, if a person does them, he shall live. And in chapter 20, verse 13 of Ezekiel, the house of Israel, though, rebelled against me in the wilderness. They didn't walk in my statutes, but rejected my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. My Sabbaths they've greatly profaned. Chapter 20, verse 21 of Ezekiel, my children rebelled against me. They didn't walk in my statutes, were not careful to obey my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. Now, where's Ezekiel getting that language that if they obey God's statutes, they will live? He's getting it from Leviticus 18, verse 5. And he is working out in his prophetic announcements to the people. God said, if you keep the statutes he's given you, you will enjoy the life that is connected to the blessing of the covenant. But you've not kept his statutes. You've rejected them. You've gone your own way in your foolishness. And so, in verses 6 through 23, he provides them direction and guardrails for their intimate activity as image bearers in the upcoming promised land. And in verse 6, you have a general statement. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. Notice in verse 6, it ends with a declaration of God again. I am the Lord. So therefore, being the one who is above all and now telling you these things, these laws are relevant. And the general principle is that within one's family, one's close relatives are not options for any kind of sexual activity or marriage. None of you shall approach any one of his close relatives. And the euphemism here, to uncover nakedness, implies not just a physical uncovering of nakedness, but all that would follow in sexual intimacy. From the fall of man, nakedness is associated with shame. Adam and Eve sought to cover their nakedness in Genesis 3, didn't they? And in Genesis 3, that connection of shame and nakedness continues forward throughout the Old Testament. So that here, to uncover nakedness in this sense is to then do what is shameful. It's to do what is sinful because it involves a close relative. Now, in verses 7 and following, a lot of examples are going to be given. And these will go very quickly because the commands that speak about these relationships will be obvious to us. In verse 7, for example, he says, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, which is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness. This is speaking with a one flesh category here. The mother and the father are so united together that it is to violate one's father, in a sense, to pursue one's mother in this way. Because the nakedness of your father is the nakedness of your mother. He says she's your mother, and you shall not uncover her nakedness. So the prohibition here among close relatives is to pursue that kind of sexual partnership with a mother. In verse 8, this is an example of someone who's not your biological mother. It refers to a stepmother. Verse 8 says, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. This is distinguishing between your mother and this is someone else your father has married, and therefore your stepmother is also prohibited. Look in verse 9. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your sister, whether it's your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether brought up in the family or in another home. I think this would eliminate a sister or a half-sister in verse 9. Verse 10 says, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter. This, therefore, is about eliminating a granddaughter as an option here, for their nakedness is your own. It's a way of saying that even though there might be an opposite sex categories here with a heterosexual relationship, it's not an appropriate relationship. There is a closeness within the family that absolutely bars this from an option by being within the family itself. In verse 11, the stepsister is mentioned. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, brought up in your father's family, because in that sense, she is your sister, your father's wife's daughter. Now, I don't have charts and graphs to sort of track these. So I hope that you see these as I mention them to you. This is the stepsister. In verse 12, the aunt on your father's side. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's relative. So that's your paternal aunt. Verse 13, the aunt on your mom's side. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is your mother's relative. In verse 14, this is about your father's, this is a paternal aunt-in-law. Okay, this is a complex one. In verse 14, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. That is, you shall not approach his wife. And so this is your paternal aunt-in-law, the aunt being the wife of your father's brother. I feel like I needed a chart. Now's not the time. In verse 15, your daughter-in-law. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. In verse 16, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. This means your sister-in-law, since your sister-in-law would be your brother's wife. Now, there is an exception to this. If your brother died without bearing children to his wife before he died, she, through the practice of levirate marriage, is able to marry the next brother so that a child might be born in the name of the deceased. So the practice of levirate marriage would be the only exception here, which Deuteronomy 25 talks about. In verse 17, you shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and of her daughter, which is a way of prohibiting her daughter. And then in verse 17, you shall not take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter, which is a grandchild relationship, to uncover her nakedness. They are relatives. It is depravity. Verse 18 says, you shall not take a woman as a rival wife to her sister. I think this means you have a living wife, and you are not to take into that marriage as well her sister, which would create a rival relationship. This would be uncovering her nakedness while her sister is still alive, the text says. Maybe an instance that you can see that would be against this commandment is Jacob, who married the sisters Leah and Rachel. That would be one instance of that from Genesis. Verse 18 forbids that. In verse 19, you are getting several other scenarios that are not family focused. Okay, let's broaden this out. So it's been focusing on relationships within the family, and it's been eliminating all sorts of different ones. And I think with the various ones it's mentioned, we can get the point. If there is a close relative through blood or through marriage into the family, they are not options. Okay, it is absolutely prohibited. And this is because coming out of Egypt and going into the promised land, they might have bad things that could be imitated that they've come from and are going into. So God from heaven must speak on this matter with authority. And in verses 19 through 23, there are five other scenarios that are not about pursuing a relative. In verse 19, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness while she is in her menstrual uncleanness. And this is taking into consideration Leviticus 15, which during the uncleanness would make you unclean yourself. And that impurity would be contracted ritually, and you would not be able to approach the tabernacle for worship. In verse 20, the next scenario, you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. This is, I think, forbidding, in general, adultery, like the seventh commandment. You shall not commit adultery. And because of lack of widespread and quick transportation, it was most likely that if adultery was to be committed by someone in a household, it would be with somebody nearby. In other words, it would be a neighbor. And therefore, he says, you shall not, in verse 20, lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean. Verse 21, this might seem like a curveball, and it doesn't immediately address an issue of sexual impurity. It says in verse 21, you shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech, and so profane the name of the Lord your God, I am the Lord. What is going on here? Who is Molech? Well, in the land of Canaan, to which they're going, the Ammonites worship the god Molech. And one of the practices in appeasing Molech was to sacrifice your children to death to this idol. He says, you shall not offer your children to Molech. And it's likely that this pagan sacrificial worship involved, like other pagan and temple and shrine worship did in the ancient world, some sort of immorality or sexual activity. This seems to be the most likely reason that this would be included amid these laws. It's not clear what that would be in detail, but that's likely why this prohibition about certain worship appears in verse 21. We have noted that there is archaeological evidence of Canaanite child sacrifice by Canaanites who were like the Phoenicians, who were really, really north, even beyond what some of the tribes were settling in. And there have been cemeteries with thousands of urns, as one writer noted, containing the burned remains of children. You even have depictions in the area of Carthage where a priest is holding up a child in the midst of a sacrificial ritual, so that even upon stone and other archaeological finds, it's clear that sacrificial worship did sometimes involve these abominable activities leading to the murder of children. Now, in verse 22, he resumes what would be a much clearer violation of sexual propriety. He says, you shall not lie with a male as with a woman. And this is to prohibit homosexuality. It is an abomination, it says in verse 22. And then in verse 23, we're moving from the realm of humans to the realm of animals. In verse 23, you shall not lie with any animal and so make yourself unclean with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to an animal to lie with it. It is a perversion. So both men and women are prohibited from what is commonly known as bestiality. Now you might think, is that really something that had to be said out loud? Well, the Hittites forbade some activity with certain animals, but permitted it with others. And so I'm just telling you that in the ancient world, there were people in that promised land who would not have held to these sexual ethics. And so I wonder if we should consider from time to time, even in our culture in 2019, where is the authority we appeal to for our understanding of sexual boundaries and guardrails of what is appropriate and why? Is it just what we would find to be desires we would have? Is it desires our friends have had and expressed? Is it relationships we're familiar with? Is it things that we see approved by culture and movies? What authority, and here what Leviticus 18 is so pronounced about, is that the God of heaven and earth is pronouncing what is wise and good for his people over against the sinful activities of Egypt preceding them and the land of Canaan in front of them. At the end of verse 23, this bestiality is called a perversion, to twist what God has presented in his created order as appropriate and honoring. It is to take that and make it something else. I want to acknowledge that in a fallen world like ours, how deeply has sin affected us? Sin affects us at the levels of our desires. Our brokenness goes down deep. And what this indicates is that the Lord is not unaware of what some people would desire to do. This is an ancient reality the Bible acknowledges, that in a broken world, what sinners may have are desires for things that are sinful before God. And therefore, since all our life is lived out before God, we need to know what God prohibits and then what relationships he would sanction. And so verses 7 through 23 give us a myriad of both in the family and outside the family kind of boundaries. Along with this, there's a promise of judgment. In verses 24 to the end of the chapter, he says, don't make yourselves unclean by any of these things. Now, by unclean, he sometimes in Leviticus speaks about uncleanness as something that just goes away after a few hours or days. And once you're clean again, you can approach the tabernacle. Uncleanness can also be used of moral transgression and not just ritual impurity. After all, in Leviticus, we've seen that there are certain uncleannesses that are not exactly something you're doing that is wrong that's brought about the uncleanness. It is possible to do something that is wrong, that renders you not just morally abhorrent before God, but also ritually unclean. And that's the situation here. In verse 24, don't make yourselves unclean by any of these things. For by all these, the nations I'm driving out before you have become unclean. And the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. He's speaking here about the upcoming conquest that Joshua will narrate. And I mean the book of Joshua, where the Canaanites, and he's speaking of it as if it's already accomplished, it's so certain, these nations will be driven out. Now, if someone says, well, now, wait a second, aren't these just specific and temporary things that were only for those Israelites? I want us to notice here that God is actually holding the Canaanites accountable for sexual wrongdoing, and they're not Israelites under a Mosaic covenant. That's because these things are not sacrificial ceremonial activities that are about the tabernacle or about dietary regulations. These are about living out one's sexuality before the God of heaven and earth. These things were wrong for the Egyptians to do, for the Canaanites to do, and if the Israelites imitate that, it's wrong for them as well. This is crucial for us to know because there's a lot of misunderstanding in approaching some commands in the Old Testament law. And Leviticus 18 is one of these commands, chapters. You'll hear sometimes where people are talking about Christian sexual ethics and somebody will bring up a ceremonial law about something you see in Leviticus 12, for example, where someone after childbirth is bringing, you know, birds to the temple after a certain number of days. And those things are fulfilled in the ministry of Christ. They aren't abiding teachings. But the ceremonial laws are different from the moral commands of God that were wrong regarding sexuality. And I mean like sins that were understood to be wrong before the law of Moses and even after the law of Moses was fulfilled in Christ. These are transcendent, non-culture-based ideas about living before God out of one's desires. And so, knowing this, it's crucial because you'll sometimes hear someone say, well, you know, in Leviticus 11, it says that you can't eat shrimp. And so in Leviticus 18, when it says, you know, you shouldn't do this, you know, aren't we not under the law? Can't we just throw out both of those things, eat fish and, you know, follow our sexual desires? It's actually not quite that simple. People want to reduce it that way, but I want you to note that the Canaanites are not being indicted for wickedness because they've eaten certain fish. They're not being indicted for abominations because they've eaten certain birds that they shouldn't have eaten in Leviticus 11. They are being indicted for violating God's order in creation, which is a transcendent reality across the ages and cultures. It's so crucial to see this because sometimes Leviticus 18 can be dismissed outright as if it's not relevant to sexual ethics. It is. After all, same-sex relationships, which is addressed in verse 22, is sometimes the thing people don't want to go to Leviticus 18 to address. Notice, however, that most of Leviticus 18 is about inner family sexual propriety and boundaries. Would we be willing to say, okay, then all of those things don't matter as well? No holds barred on those issues too. No, we don't. And then bestiality that's addressed at the very end. What's difficult is when we put ourselves forward to be the authority of what sexual ethics we can approve or not approve when God has said, I am the Lord, and here is what I am telling you is wise and good and right. So the challenge we have before us, and it's always the challenge of the people of God in any culture, because they lived with Egypt before them and the Canaanites in front of them. The challenge was always, on whose authority will we conduct ourselves sexually? On whose authority? Whose worldview will we live out and submit to? Because this would have been something that stood out in the ancient world. It's not like this wouldn't have been strange or countercultural. It would have been, which is why he's addressing it from Egypt behind them and Canaan in front of them. Look in verse 25. He says, "The land became unclean, punishing its iniquity. The land vomited out its inhabitants." He's speaking about the coming conquest as if it's already happened. The land vomiting it out. That's a really grotesque image, isn't it? The land personified there as if it's sick to its stomach with something. And then all of a sudden, blah. Now what it's vomiting out, it's picturing people that are conquered and exiled and destroyed. He says in verse 26, "But you shall keep my statutes and my rules and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you." Abominations is what they're called. These are God's rules. And to violate these, to live as if you are the God of your own life and as if you call the shots about what is right and wrong, that's to ignore the voice of God himself who has spoken on the intimate matters of our lives. Don't you see the whole reason Leviticus 18 exists is because God cares about his people. He cares about his creation. He wants them to function wisely and righteously before him. But he knows how deep our sin's brokenness and fracturing goes. We need God's guidance and wisdom on these matters. We don't just think to ourselves, well, what is it that I would want or what I think is appropriate? And I'll just be the gauge there. Leviticus 18 says, God is the Lord and has spoken, and therefore his words must be embraced. He says in verse 27, "The people of the land who were before you did all these abominations, so the land became unclean." In verse 28, "Lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nation before you." So he's warning them about judgment. He will not spare them. They can't say, "Hey, you know what? The reason we don't have to live with any sexual boundaries is because we're Israelites." He says the land's going to vomit you out too. "I will bring judgment because you are rejecting my good law and my statutes." In verse 29, "For everyone who does any of these abominations, the persons who do them shall be cut off from among their people." That's a picture of judgment. Maybe not just exile. Maybe cut off there means death. In verse 30, "So keep my charge never to practice any of these abominable customs that were practiced before you, and never to make yourselves unclean by them." And then he ends with, "I am the Lord your God." And part of what we are challenged to do then as the people of God is to say, if the Lord has spoken on this subject, then what am I going to do with the revelation of God? If he has spoken as the all-loving and all-wise God who is holy and righteous, and he cares about me and his commands come from love so that I will not walk in disobedience and foolishness, then what will I do with his loving commands for my life? Now, this chapter ends with God's authority over all of their lives. And we can note that throughout the Old Testament, there were many Bible characters whose lives violated any number of these laws. So I'm going to give you some examples here in our remaining time of how certain other Bible characters and relationships can be seen in light of what we've just read. For instance, think about Lot. Lot in Genesis 19 is seduced by his two daughters. And in Genesis 19, 30 and 38, you see an example of incest. And that incestual activity would be a violation of Leviticus 18. Abraham is married to his half-sister Sarah, according to Genesis 20, verse 12. Jacob married two sisters, Rachel and Leah. Well, Leah first. Judah had relations with his daughter-in-law, Tamar, in Genesis 38. Reuben, a son of Jacob, had relations with his father's concubine, Bilhah, in Genesis 35:22. In 2 Samuel 13, Absalom had a brother named Amnon who desired Absalom's sister, Tamar. And then you have, in the New Testament, examples like John the Baptist coming against Herod Antipas because of an incestuous marriage that had resulted. You even have the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, who speaks very strongly to the Corinthians about an issue they've tolerated. He says in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 1, "It's actually reported there's sexual immorality among you and of a kind not tolerated among pagans. A man has his father's wife." Why would Paul be so exercised? Because this, for the new covenant church, would not be appropriate. This is a violation, not of just something that existed under the law of Moses, but an ongoing set of sexual propriety and impropriety boundaries that, according to Paul writing to the Corinthians, was something that ought not be tolerated. These are just a few examples. We also see same-sex relationships addressed by Paul in Romans 1 and 1 Corinthians 6 and 1 Timothy 1, continuing the same vein of thought of God's moral law governing our sexual relationships that's rooted in Leviticus 18. What I'm trying to show you by making both Old and New Testament references is that we are not to look at Leviticus 18, which addresses God's moral guidance for our sexual lives, and say, well, wait a second, isn't that in the same string of chapters as addressing shellfish and sewing two garments together? So because we can just think of every command as exactly the same kind of category, we can just dismiss Leviticus 18, right? It's not so simple. We have to think nuancedly about God's law, carefully and thoughtfully about what's being addressed and why. And I just want you to notice that in Leviticus 18, it's not just the Israelites who would be condemned if they engaged in this activity. The Canaanites and the Egyptians were not in a covenant with the Israelites at Mount Sinai. And the Canaanites are being described as those who are doing what is abominable before God. That's because this is not something limited to the covenant with Moses or to the Israelite community. Otherwise, holding the Canaanites accountable would make no sense. It would be unfair. The Canaanites would be able to say before the judgment seat of God, God, don't you know? We weren't under the covenant with Moses. We weren't in the Israelite community. So therefore, Leviticus 18 didn't apply to us. It has to do with God's created design and pattern, knowing that the brokenness of sin goes down deep within us, including the level of our desires. One other famous example that I think Leviticus 18 shines some light on is Genesis chapter 9, where you see Noah and his family have emerged from the ark, and there is a very disturbing description of an activity where Noah's son Ham, it says, looked upon his father's nakedness. Now, and there's quite a strong reaction in Noah's heart, and Noah actually pronounces a curse upon the future descendant named Canaan. Now, that's interesting. Okay, so holding that thought for a second, Canaanites, which would have originally come from at least this son Canaan who settles in this area, we have the story in Genesis 9 about uncovering his father's nakedness. And I want you to know that Leviticus 18, along with the rest of the law of Moses, would be for the Israelites to understand as a coherent whole, so that previous things that happened before the law might be even more clearly understood with certain regulations and commands. It's progressive revelation. The more they know, the more they're able to understand certain things that came before them. And in Genesis chapter 9, some readers have wondered, well, what was so bad about just uncovering his father's nakedness? But in Leviticus 18, to uncover your father's nakedness was to involve the mother in sexual impropriety. And so when you see something like Genesis 9 reporting the unconscionable act of Ham, there are Old Testament scholars who argue that that isn't just a physical description of taking some sort of covering or blanket off of Noah. It's actually something on another level as well, sexually indecent and immoral. I have favored this interpretation for a long time. It's been a number of years since we preached the book of Genesis. But in Genesis chapter 9, I argued this particular perspective many moons ago. I don't know how many years ago that is at this point. But it's worth revisiting tonight by just mentioning that, why was Noah reacting so strongly? And why would he be reacting so strongly, not against Ham directly, but even pronouncing a curse on a child that Ham would have? A child with whom? And so I think having Leviticus 18 read along with Genesis 9 can explain more about what was sinister, perhaps, something sexually immoral that Ham was involved in, probably with his mother. The reason you would do that in an ancient Near Eastern world is for a power grab, to assert oneself as a new head of the household, to in some way displace the father as the reigning patriarch. And so this was something that was despicable for Ham to have done, not only against against his mother, but a deep and abiding insult against his father as well. I think that not only explains the sinister act, I think it also helps explain why Noah reacted so strongly. There's language there that I think Leviticus 18 shines its light on. When we end tonight, I want to end thinking about the way we began. These commands, which address very intimate topics, which address things in certain amount of detail. And again, you know, this is not something you would probably ever hear somebody preach through or address in any specificity, unless you're looking in a series of chapters like we are doing. So it's good that we've thought about these things. I think it can help us make other Old Testament and New Testament connections. But I want to remind us that God loves us more than we love us. And his commands show that he is calling us to do what will not only be honoring to him, but is actually for our greatest good. God's commands to us is not about God holding out on us. I fear that we've looked at God's law, and as sinners and image bearers, we've misunderstood what freedom looks like. We've been suspicious of the goodness and wisdom of God, and we think we know better. And maybe our desires are a safe gauge. I want us to reevaluate that approach, though, and consider that the Lord our God, who has made us, knows what is best for us, and his commands are for our good and for our deepest and most lasting joy. Maybe you could say, as one pastor did, that God is more committed to our joy than we are, because we sometimes think sin might make sense. We sometimes might think transgression might be justified, or ignoring some aspect of God's commands is preferable, which shows how short-circuited our thinking about our lives can be. Let us look at Leviticus 18 and think afresh. We need to trust the Lord. We need to commit ourselves to the ways and wisdom of God, for he knows what is wise and good and righteous for his people. And that is for our deep and lasting joy, not holding out on us. It is sin's nature and heinousness that we need to identify and expose. The lies and deception and bankruptcy of sin's promises. Those things are not true regarding the Lord's promises. His commands are good and righteous, and his promises will be kept because he is faithful. Not only can I trust him, I can submit even to things that might challenge our desires, things that seem difficult to follow and obey, statutes and rules that might even not make as much sense in our culture as in previous generations. And we also don't know where things are headed beyond 2019. We need God's abiding, lasting word for us, for he cares for us and loves us more than we can even care and love ourselves. Knowing the loving heart of God behind his commands, why wouldn't we trust him with all that we are?